Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Salieri Report. It is my privilege to welcome back a woman who needs no introduction on the Salieri Report, and that is Amy Benjamin, who hails from Auckland and is a professor teaching law at the University in Auckland and has joined us on several occasions. There are many people who say that her interview with us on secrecy was the best Salieri Report we ever did. So if you haven't listened to the previous Amy Benjamins, I strongly recommend them. And this is a woman with an incredible knowledge of the law. She has experience in practicing law, including at the Department of Justice, so she knows the U.S. system well. But she also knows a great deal about international law. And I realized that I wanted to discuss the Nuremberg principles. They kept coming up of late, in particular with some of the solutions being proposed for coronavirus. And so I called Amy and I said, could you get on the Salieri Report right away? And I'm very grateful that she said yes. So Amy, welcome to the Salieri Report.
Hi, Catherine. It's lovely to speak with you as always.
Okay, so Nuremberg principles, this is something you know a great deal about. And as you pointed out earlier, you teach them. This is, you know, this is something you teach people about.
I do teach them about it because for international law, it's the Nuremberg principles, in a sense, are the, can't overstate their importance, the Magna Carta, the Constitution, because, you know, they were announced, they came out of the Nuremberg war crimes trials, trials of the senior Nazi leadership right after World War II, and they were sort of codified by a UN commission right after the trials ended. And, you know, they're very short, but what they set out is incredibly important for international law. So they do form the heart of the international law paper that I teach to undergraduates here.
So walk us through the principles. What do the principles say?
Well, they do two things. One is they define in some detail the international crimes which were prosecuted at the Nuremberg war crimes trials, and the main one being aggressive war, the crime of aggressive war, or it was called at the trials a crime against peace. I think the French were the ones that gave it that appellation. It's very poetic, a crime against peace, if peace is a person. And then war crimes, you know, the crimes that soldiers commit during war, for example, violating the principle against discrimination or distinction, you can't target civilians and the like, or shooting prisoners when they try to surrender and the like. And then there was a new one, which was extremely novel at the time, crimes against humanity, which were crimes committed against any civilian population, including a domestic population. And they introduced this crime, which was completely novel and turned a lot of heads at the time, because they wanted to be able to prosecute things that happened in Germany, crimes committed by the Nazi regime against their own citizenry, so not against the citizenry of occupied territories in war, which would be come under war crimes, right? That was easy. But what about the things the Nazis had done to groups in their own country, so homosexuals and Jews and gypsies and communists, both before the war and during the war? These were crimes that had never been crimes before. It had never been suggested that they were crimes, or that international law, which is international between nations, that international law could reach intranational events.
Right.
So this was huge. So the principles set forth the crimes that were prosecuted in Nuremberg. And they did, the second major thing they did was they said that individual statesmen and officials could be held accountable for these crimes, that the nation state wouldn't be accountable, as Germany had been held accountable after World War I en masse with, you know, the reparations. After World War II, the international community forsook that route and said, no, we're not going to do collective guilt and hold the whole nation accountable. We're going to go after the individuals responsible, the senior leadership and the senior politicians and the senior governing officials. And that had never been done before. And so the principles basically said, look, if you commit, if you're responsible for getting your nation to commit a crime under international law, you, the national official, will be held accountable, regardless of what the national law said, regardless if the national law allowed you to commit the international crime or even directed you to commit the international crime. National law can no longer serve as a shield for violating international law. It can't immunize you if you violate international law. So you will be held accountable in your nation's law, if it's violent or if it directed you to commit the crime, can't be used as defense, basically. So that's the second major thing the principles did. They established the supremacy of international law over national law in a very small area related to a crime of aggression, war crimes, and, interestingly, crimes against humanity.
Now, crimes against humanity include slave trafficking.
It includes murder, extermination, enslavement. Yes, I think enslavement is specified in the principles,
right.
Literally specified, and then other inhuman acts, okay? And then if you fast forward to the end of the 20th century when you have the establishment of the International Criminal Court, crimes against humanity is more developed by that time because you're almost 60 years on, and it's in the Rome Statute, which established the International Criminal Court, and the elements of crimes against humanity are much more numerous, and yes, would encompass and do encompass trafficking and the like.
Right. And when these were developed, so they came out of the trials, what was the process by which they were adopted by the United Nations?
I think the International Law Commission, which is sort of the committee that looks at developments of international law and then seeks to state them in kind of a, restate them in sort of a codified form, did that with respect to the verdicts that were delivered, the judgments that were delivered, because of course, the Nuremberg trial, the main trial, there were judgments, many judgments respecting the defendants.
Mm-hmm.
And so the International Law Commission took those judgments and tried, and from those distilled down the principles and then proposed that to the General Assembly, and it was adopted by the General Assembly.
Now, then how does that convert into something that can be used to enforce?
Well, it can't really. I mean, the short answer is it can be used certainly to shame. And in terms of enforcement, you'd have to look to probably the International Criminal Court and the Rome Statute, because the Rome Statute is called the Rome Statute, but it is a treaty that is the founding document for the International Criminal Court. Well, it took the crimes enunciated in the principles, crime of aggression and war crimes, and crimes against humanity, and added genocide. And those are the crimes that can be prosecuted before the ICC, the International Criminal Court. So if you're looking for enforcement, you would have to look at the jurisdictional provisions of the ICC. But the ICC's jurisdiction is very hard to bring to bear against a non-state party. And the United States, for example, is not a state party.
Right.
It's a non-state party. So the prohibitions against crimes against humanity, for example, in the Rome Statute, how could you hold, you know, for example, U.S. officials accountable? Well, for a crime against humanity, probably the only sort of jurisdictional avenue under the ICC would be if the Security Council were to sign off on a referral to the ICC prosecutor for that. But of course, the United States would veto that in the Security Council. So for all intents and purposes, the non-party P5, non-party to the treaty, and that's China, Russia, and the United States, they're immune before the ICC for anything they do to their own citizens, because they would veto a Security Council referral.
Right.
Now, Britain and France are parties, so, you know, they might be a bit more vulnerable, but as just a matter of power, they could certainly stymie the ICC from going anywhere. So just as a matter of practicality, the United States is immune, really.
So, well, they certainly act like they are.
That doesn't mean they're not relevant as a political matter, but as a legal matter.
Absolutely.
The political matter, they're very relevant.
Right.
The substance of the principles, but also the substance of the Nuremberg Code, which is specific to crimes committed in war of a medical nature. The Nuremberg Code, we can get into that, but certainly that as a political matter, that's deeply relevant to many of the issues.
So let's talk about the Nuremberg Code. How did that develop?
Some of the inhuman acts, be they crimes against humanity, meaning against their own civilian population, or war crimes, meaning against people in the occupied territories, that the Nazis did were of a medical nature. The medical experimentation that they did, for example, on concentration camp prisoners are well known. Just think, you know, Dr. Mengele, for example. And there was a consensus the German medical profession had kind of gone off the deep end and had basically, in the name of science, committed atrocities against human beings, you know, in the name of making medical progress. And, you know, these would be either crimes against humanity if committed against Germans or war crimes. And so there were medical advisors advising the prosecution, and they saw to it that a number of principles that kind of, you know, sound in clinical research ethics, right? What you can do when you're trying to do clinical research and using human subjects. They saw to it that certain principles came out of the trials. And I don't know if those principles were literally included in the judgments or not. Some sources say yes, but I haven't gone and looked at it. But nonetheless, in the wake of the trials, these principles, this code, if you will, of clinical research ethics or medical ethics concerning the do's and don'ts of human experimental subjects did emerge. And,
right.
And there was really, you know, not a lot of controversy about them. I mean, we can talk about the two main pillars of that ethical code, which is informed consent, and humans can't be basically a means to an end to a larger
right.
end. Can't be used to a means to a larger end. Those are the two pillars. But there wasn't a lot of controversy, and some Western doctors sniffed, oh, you know, this is a code for barbarians. It doesn't apply to Western non-German doctors because we don't do this sort of thing.
Right. No, it's very funny to see the arrogance at the time towards them.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, those two pillars, the one of informed consent and sort of the prohibition against sort of the utilitarian treatment of humans, you know, in the name of scientific progress, you know, you can't.
So, yeah, so if you look at the relationship between the Nuremberg Code and the Hippocratic Oath, or the, there's also the Helsinki Accord, there's a huge amount of serious effort to establish the clear line that you should never, you know, that a doctor or healthcare professional should never cross. And what's interesting about both the principles and the code, I remember when I was in high school, I went to a Quaker day school, we had these beaten into us. It was unthinkable that a civilized country would ever cross any of these lines. And yet, you know, particularly in recent history, we're blowing by these lines as though they don't exist and acting like it's perfectly fine. You know, if you had these things beaten into you in high school, I just find it absolutely amazing.
I tend to think of that as, look, and I'm sure many would agree, there has been, over the last 70 years, an overall Nazification of the American culture. Medical ethics relating to human experimentation is just one aspect of it. Look at the surveillance state. Look at national security.
Right.
The national security state. Look at the corporate control of government. Look at the police state tactics. Look at the spying. Look at the, I mean, it's everywhere. Look at the empire. Look at the American empire. We were never supposed to be an empire.
Right.
Karl Rove famously said to reporters, we're an empire now. Well, when did that happen? I mean, you know, it's the progressive Nazification represented most historically and specifically by Operation Paperclip, when we imported all the
right.
Nazi scientists and we co-opted the Nazi spy apparatus, Galen spy apparatus, and basically the CIA in the early post-war period were a bunch of ex-Nazi spy masters. So,
right. If you look at the experimentation that continued, you know, it's almost like the research continued uninterrupted.
No, it did. You had MK Ultra, and then you had, this was uncovered in the 1970s. So much came out in the 70s, but you had, and also in the 1970s, a lesser scandal. It took place in the 1950s where we were injecting Guatemalan peasants with syphilis and other things to see, you know, what would happen.
Right.
And, you know, it's hideous, and I can't help but think that some of that was instigated by these ex-Nazi scientists who obviously saw nothing wrong at using human guinea pigs in the name of scientific medical progress to see what would happen. And, you know, that is the second major pillar, apart from, you know, informed consent. What the Nuremberg Code basically says is that one human being can't be deemed the means to the end of scientific knowledge. And there was a very specific
right.
event or crime that happened during the war that was in many people's minds at the end of it and in the minds of those who wrote the code, and that was during the war, the German Air Force, Luftwaffe, had a number of pilots who were being shot down over the North Sea. And of course, if they survived the crash, they'd be in very cold water. And the Luftwaffe, directed by Hermann Göring, wanted to know how long the pilots could survive and the temperatures of the North Sea, the frigid North Sea water, before drowning, so they would know, you know, if it was worth sending out a rescue, whatever, to try to get them. Because, you know, if they were going to die within 5 minutes, you know, no point. So one experiment the Nazi doctors was that they'd take a concentration camp prisoner and plunge them into freezing water and see how long it was before they died. Now, was that done for scientific purposes? I guess very narrowly construed it was. You were advancing medical knowledge, weren't you? But you were taking a human being and using them as the means to, in a very utilitarian sense, you know, for the greater good. You're taking an Untermenschen, a member of a subgroup of humanity, and saying you will die so that we will have medical knowledge that might be able to save more important lives. Now, that's a big no-no now. That's a big no-no. Right. And yet, it's being done in China right now, where they're taking critical prisoners, I think, of Muslim critical prisoners, and they're organ harvesting off of them in order to make sure that, you know, members of the Communist Party, senior members, have the organs they need to live long lives. And it's arguably happening in the whole vaccination scenario, because, you know, I know that the general line of the pro-vaccination establishment is that they don't cause the many problems that do seem evident from them, such as, you know, the epidemic and autism. The line is, no, you're mistaken. There's no causal link between vaccines and, for example, the MMR and autism. That's kind of the establishment's first line of defense. But what I really think is going on, I think what may be going on, I don't have proof of this, but what I suspect is going on, is that many in the medical establishment don't buy that argument, and they know that there's a causal link. Because one reason I suspect that is because they have exempted pharmaceutical companies from, they've made them immune from lawsuits for product liability, right? If there's no causal link, why say they can't be sued, you know? Let them be sued, and then and then the suits will fail, right? So I suspect that's what's going on, Catherine, in the vaccine scenario, is that many, many medical professionals know there's a causal link, but basically solve their consciences by saying, you know, it's for the greater good. We know, we do know that vaccines will do harm in 5% of cases, but it's the herd will benefit. The herd will benefit. Right. And that, in a sense, is, I think, in a very real sense, a violation of that principle that one human being shall not be sacrificed for the herd or for the greater good or for the life of anyone else.
Right, but I also, my guess is that it's not true either. You know, it's a great cop-out, but I doubt it's true. If you look, I just finished watching Vax 2. I don't know if you've had a chance to see it.
No.
It's absolutely stunning. And several people make the case. What happens is that the Vax team goes on the road with Vax, the first Vaxed, and all these parents start showing up, and they're overwhelmed by the flow of parents and healthcare practitioners. And, you know, they did Vax 1 on the MMR, but this is people, you know, every, you name it, all the vaccines. And the flow is just unbelievable, and the story is even more unbelievable. And so finally, the travel becomes overwhelming, and Polly Toomey says, oh, well, let's buy a bus. So they buy a bus, and they start filming all the people who come to talk to them, which are thousands and thousands. And it becomes absolutely so depressing, this overwhelming flow of disabled and injured and dead children, that Polly said, look, I can't take this anymore. Let's start talking to and filming non-vaccinated children. And in fact, a lot of the non-vaccinated children turned out to be in families where they'd vaccinated the first child. That child had been injured, and so they didn't vaccinate any others. And so you see the comparison in the same family, same DNA, same household, same food. And it's astonishing. And then several practitioners said, look, they have to mandate vaccines, because when you look at how much healthier the unvaccinated are, you know, at some point, no one's going to vaccinate, because no one wants to destroy their children's chance for a healthy life.
Yeah, I think there are different justifications given for mandatory vaccines. I think there are three different ones, and we need to keep separate. The one that sort of the establishment has gauged the public is that there is no causal link. Don't be silly, you're a conspiracy theorist. Sit down and shut up and take your vaccine. That's where much of the battle is engaged, over whether there's a causal link. I suspect, though, that for many well-meaning doctors out there, they know that there's a causal link, but they salve their consciences with this idea, which is impermissible under the Nuremberg Code, that some have to be damaged. It's inevitable. Some will be damaged, but the herd will benefit over the all. I think that may be what their unacknowledged rationale is. It's impermissible, but I think that it might be what it is. And then there's a third rationale, which is even deeper, which is, no, it's not even a utilitarian one. It's just, we will harm these people. We have an agenda to degrade the population, to control them. And that's the, you know, off the charts evil one that, that of course, runs afoul of the Nuremberg Code. The last two, the, you know, sacrifice the individual for the herd, and the we want to harm them, degrade them in order to control them, they definitely violate Nuremberg. The first one, which is, no, no, it's good for you and it's good for the herd. You're just a conspiracy theorist to think it's harmful. Now, that doesn't violate Nuremberg, and that's where much of the battle is joined, because in that first rationale, they're saying it's good for you, it's good for you.
But if you disagree and say, I disagree, and I have religious and personal objections, and I don't want it, then the question is, who controls my body? Is it the state or me? On what grounds do they have the right to force me?
That's an excellent point. When can the state control our bodies, either regarding what we can put into our own bodies, for example, smoking and the like, or whether the state wants to force into our own bodies against our will? Now, when there's a great amount of consensus about the medical issue, for example, in the case of smoking, the population is willing to permit the government to be extremely coercive. I mean, just think in the last 20 years, how smokers have been completely marginalized in society. You know, they have to go, you know, 5 miles away from the building where they're working in order to light up. And you don't really hear a peep out of the population. And the reason you don't, I mean, you hear a lot of grumbling by the smokers, of course. But the general population is okay with that because there's widespread consensus that smoking does cause cancer and blah, blah, blah. And secondhand smoke is even dangerous and blah, blah, blah. And so there is consensus, okay? In the case of non-consensus, though, in the case of acute controversy, right, then what will we allow the state to do? Let's consider the abortion context, and we can hang the pro-vaccine people who tend to be leftists, you know, on their own petard. In the abortion context, Catherine, you know, the issue is, can the state intervene and prevent a woman from doing what she wants to do with her own body, i.e. end a pregnancy? Now, what Roe basically stands for is, there is great controversy about when life begins. And the controversy is that it's greatest in the first trimester. Some say it begins at conception, others say it doesn't begin until viability, or at least not till the second trimester, blah, blah, blah. And so what Roe basically says, and Roe says, you know, it is unconstitutional for a state to seek to interfere with a woman in the first trimester. So the state cannot force a woman to carry a baby from the moment of conception. It can force a woman to carry a baby after the second trimester. And during the second trimester, I think things are a little bit murky, but definitely at the onset of the third trimester, it is not unconstitutional for a state to say to a woman, you must carry this baby to term. Okay. Now, what I'm saying is, where there is controversy about whether a fetus is a human being in that first trimester, the constitutional rule is in favor of autonomy, in favor of individual autonomy, right? So why?
Right.
And we should apply that to the vaccine. There is controversy, so it should be resolved in favor of human autonomy. In the abortion context, the woman is able to, in the first trimester, because there's controversy about when life begins, exercise her human autonomy to the point of putting an end to this incipient life. So I would think that there's a very good argument to be made that in the vaccine context, if there's reasonable room for disagreement about the safety of vaccines, the default should be in favor of personal autonomy, and someone should be able to exempt themselves from a legal requirement to vaccinate, even if, now this won't result in immediate death to others, as is the case in the abortion context, but it could at most result in a greater likelihood of others contracting a disease.
So let me be the economics person. You know, when I look at these issues, what it says to me is, when the pharmaceutical companies want fetal tissue, it's fine for a woman to have an abortion. When the pharmaceutical companies want to give people vaccines, then autonomy can be overruled. In other words, to me, one of the drivers here is, you know, because I think a lot of the evolution of abortion law in this country is driven by the demand on the part of pharmaceutical companies for more and more fetal tissue.
Yeah, absolutely. But my point is, they're not going to acknowledge that, and so let's take advantage of that. And as a matter of principle, you know, if autonomy rules for women in that first trimester, for the reasons I've mentioned, why doesn't autonomy rule for people who don't want to take vaccinations?
Right.
I mean, in the abortion context, that's resulting in immediate death of that fetus. Whereas in the vaccination context, it's only resulting, the refusal to vaccinate is only resulting to a higher probability of contraction of a disease that may be overcomable. So, you know, let's use their principles against them.
Right. Absolutely. Well, So let's go back to the Nuremberg Code. Has there been any discussion that you're aware of people turning and saying, in the last 20 years, these are serious violations of both the Nuremberg Principles and the Nuremberg Codes? What's going on? Have the parties who are promoting the violation of these principles and codes, is that being pointed out to them? Is there any pushback?
In academic circles?
Anywhere that you know of.
I have not seen, you know, these principles, or more particularly the code, formally invoked by anybody. I haven't canvassed the literature. But I do think that the sense that these principles, and in particular the code, are being violated is sort of what is implicitly motivating a lot of resistance to what the establishment is doing. For example, take the notion of informed consent, right? Now, informed consent means not only should a subject of treatment or experimentation, well, it means two things. They should have knowledge that they are a subject of treatment or experimentation, okay? They should know that something is being done to them. And number two, they should know the risks and the benefits of that procedure. Now, why are we so aggravated over this notion about what they may or may not be spraying in the atmosphere for whatever potentially beneficent reasons, such as combating climate change or whatever? Why are we so up in arms about that? Well, because that violates the right to informed consent. We don't cite the Nuremberg Code, but it's that principle that comes out of the Nuremberg Code. We don't even know we're being sprayed. So that secrecy, that cuts against, that goes, that's a dagger right in the heart of informed consent. We might be the subject of a huge scientific experiment, and we don't even know it. So when you ask, you know, are these principles, is this code in particular, being invoked? Well, formally, I'm not sure, but implicitly, very much so, because those two pillars of the code, informed consent and the prohibition against using human beings in a utilitarian-like fashion, you know, they animate the modern consciousness.
Right. I absolutely believe we'll have them linked, both the principles and the code and some of the related, you know, the Hippocratic Oath, some of the others that relate to the Nuremberg Code. We'll have them linked in the commentary. And I really think it serves every citizen of whatever country to read them and understand them, and to understand that behavior that contradicts these is really, you know, the tradition of our culture is it's not acceptable. It's not acceptable for a doctor to violate the Nuremberg Code or the Hippocratic Oath. And I've had several experiences. It's funny, you know, my father trained us well to be suspicious of doctors. And a couple times I've been in a doctor's office and had them sail right across the line. And unfortunately for them, fortunately for me, I'm well trained. And when you call them out and you cite chapter and verse of what the rules are that apply, they really, you know, they turn bright red and back down. So there's real power in knowing these and applying them to your day-to-day circumstances. They're important, and they can, you know, they can really count in a pinch. So I think it's worth learning them.
Like I said, the legal remedies under them are practically non-existent, but as a political matter and as a shaming mechanism, especially the idea that our doctors, our American medical personnel are running afoul of rules written to curb Nazi abuses, you know, it's a hugely potent shaming mechanism and a political tool. Just because we don't have a legal remedy directly under these principles or the code, you know, via, for example, the ICC, that's regrettable, I suppose, but that doesn't mean they're not effective, and they should be cited, you know. You know, it can be as simple as you're doing the same thing the Nazi doctors did. It's just dressed up a little differently. What? I am? What do you mean? You know, or to the CDC or the the FDA or, you know, they should be invoked because they unmask the Nazification of American medicine.
Well, you know, it was extraordinary. I don't know if you saw any of the excerpts from the vaccine summit in Switzerland. It was quite
remarkable.
No,
that overwhelmed me with emotion.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, here's what was interesting, because I've followed pretty closely the different pushback in multiple countries. And what you saw was the pushback has become so educated and knowledgeable from both parents and healthcare practitioners, country by country by country. And they had a presentation by a doctor from London whose job as an anthropologist is to determine why vaccines are getting so much pushback. And what she came back with is, we don't have scientific proof of safety. And then you had the head of the Nigeria program say, well, not only do we not have proof of safety for individual vaccines, but there's no scientific evidence to say that when you put all these different vaccines with all these different adjuvants in one little body, that all of that cocktail together is safe. And what was interesting,
the ultimate crime against humanity. This is criminal negligence, although I think it goes beyond that. I think it goes to intentional.
Right. No, it's clearly
the mens rea here. I think it goes to intentional genocide.
Well, but here's what was so interesting about it. Everyone, including the woman running the global program, looked stalled and scared and ashamed. I don't remember seeing one person who wasn't ashamed. And what you could tell is, you know, we've now killed and injured enough people that even the people running the global program are stalled because they're ashamed. And I think some of the things that have happened since then can be explained by the fact that, you know, the powers that be watching the videos would say, uh-oh, we really got a problem. Because now the people running the program are, you know, so it's not just the parents and the healthcare practitioners and the program staff country by country, but it's the global staff that's all stalled and being forced to face the fact on public videotape that they have no safety studies. It's quite extraordinary.
These scientists who love to lecture non-scientists about the scientific method and fact over myth and correlation and causation. You know, you get an earful every time you talk to one of these people who, you know, one of the many who are not repentant and haven't seen the real evidence.
Right.
And all they do is lecture you, and it's just sickening. It's just sickening because actually the facts cut against them and the science cuts against them, and what they have prescribed for decades is deeply scientifically flawed. And it's heartbreaking. And I think of these babies, and I've often thought, you know, because I've got 20-year-old and an 18-year-old, and I think they survived their vaccinations. But I'm, of course, thinking ahead to my grandchildren and the lengths I'm going to go to make sure they're protected. And
make sure you watch Facts 2 and get your kids to watch it, because it's very, very impactful.
Yeah, we've got to find a solution here, because, you know, there is, to some extent, the opt-out solution with homeschooling and the like, but that's a really imperfect solution because many people can't afford to opt out. And, you know, the same with, you know, trying to opt out of public fluoride treatment. Yes, some people can afford to buy their own water or expensive water filters, but many can't. So, you know, really, we have to go higher up the political food chain, if you will, and solve it there. The opt-out is nice, but I do think opt-out in the case of Vax is going to become increasingly more difficult.
Well, but here's the thing. The real question here, and when I first saw the Vaccine Summit excerpts, I said, How many scientists can you buy for $21 trillion? Apparently a lot.
Yeah.
And so I would say that the principle that is now way out of balance is the principle between control, responsibility, and authority. So I'm a parent, and I'm responsible as a legal fiduciary and guardian for a child, but the state can order me to do all sorts of things that make the child sick, and or make the child behave in ways that are out of control and I can't discipline. And the state makes me pay for a school that's teaching, you know, if I'm in California, it's teaching my child how to be a sex slave. So
we're getting
further and further into the state mandates I pay, and then what I get is something that destroys my economics. So the state mandates a vaccine, and now I need $5 million for a, you know, for a heavily autistic child to take care of that child for the rest of their life. And I'm financially responsible. And so there's a real imbalance between who pays and who's legally responsible and who has the authority and control to be able to perform under those obligations. And this is a very serious economic issue. It's funny, I always tell this story, so I'm sure the Salary Report subscribers have heard it before. I had a wonderful grandparent who I spent a lot of time trying to provide information on vaccines for him to use with his child. And he kept saying, look, it's none of my business. And I said, yes, it is. Because if your grandchild becomes heavily injured from vaccines, it's going to cost you $5 million because your kid doesn't have $5 million, but you do. So it is your business because you're going to pay. You're the banker. And you've got to assert banker's rights here. So the money, the financial aspects of this, I can't tell you how many families I've seen destroyed by violations of healthcare freedoms. It's the way I'll describe it because it's far bigger than just vaccines. I wanted to also ask you, Amy, you have done a lot of work on the weaponization of human rights. It's something I've talked with you about, and we don't have time to get into it deeply, but part of the challenge I see is if you look at the Nuremberg principles of the Nuremberg Code, what I call the shriekometer is quite clever in using those to weaponize them to, you know, engineer regime change or affect sort of political power in a situation. A lot of, you know, the United States has been very clever at abusing some of these sort of standards.
Yes. You know, regime change operations in the name of freedom and democracy have ruined Libya, Syria, the Ukraine, and they tried to undermine Russia. So it's highly detrimental to the human condition, these human rights campaigns.
Right.
And then human rights for sort of the quote-unquote first world countries, they're used to set up divide and conquer. So, you know, the human rights of women, well, it's not just to bring women up to a level playing field. It's to undermine maleness, to undermine
right.
the confidence and the capacity to serve and the reputation of, you know, an entire biological sex, male, through notions of toxic masculinity and the like. And with homosexuals,
right.
it's not enough for a marriage equality. No, no, no. Now you've got to take that into the whole transsexual, trans kids, get away from binary notions of sex, you know, genderless bathrooms, the whole thing. And it's carried to such an extreme. It's meant to break down more conservative values of more conservative cultures. I would say
right.
sane values of sane cultures, not just conservative values of conservative cultures. And so it's a two-prong agenda. For the weaker countries, it's the overthrow of regimes. And for the stronger countries, it's to divide and conquer the population of men against women and straight against gay and black against white and legally resident against non-legally resident, you know, the whole immigration
right.
thing and open borders. So, you know, it's just a beast and it has different prongs to it.
So one of the things we've seen is the U.S. get quite clever over the last 20 years at applying and using economic sanctions. And one of the principles that they've applied is the right to go through the sovereign government and apply sanctions to an individual, irregardless of whether they were acting under orders or in accordance with the domestic law, very much like what you were describing with the Nuremberg principles. Was there any connection with sort of that principle flowing from the Nuremberg principles into the economic sanctions practice that you know of?
Well, I mean, interesting question. On the face of it, to sanction the individuals and say that any permissive, you know, state legislation can't shield them, you know, if they were acting in consistently with their nation's laws, can't shield them. That would seem to be, you know, very much in line with Nuremberg's supremacy of international law over national law. On the other hand, the reason I think the United States' practice of slapping sanctions is not okay is that economic sanctions under the UN Charter, there's a very good argument to be made, and I make it to my own students, that they were meant to go through the Security Council because under Chapter 7, the economic sanctions was a weapon to be decided upon by the Security Council, not unilaterally, because economic force is not military force, but it is force. And there's a general prohibition right. in the UN Charter about the unilateral application of force. And if you go to Chapter 7 in the UN Charter, it's clear that economic sanctions are one tool that the founders of the Charter, the founders of the UN, the writers of the Charter, thought would be a tool for the Security Council, not for individual states. So I've made an argument to my students that unilateral economic sanctions in the name of international law are a violation of the UN Charter. The United States can say, well, we're just trying to, vindicate international law against contravening national law. And Nuremberg says we can go after individuals to do that. That's true, except they're not taking account the fact that the unilateral aspect of their decision making runs afoul, arguably, of the UN Charter. And that these decisions to go after individuals in the name of international law have to go through the Security uh-huh. Council. So is Nuremberg relevant? Yeah, but it's not dispositive.
Right. So when you teach your kids about, your students, about the principles and anything related to the Nuremberg trial, what is their response? What is their reaction? What do they find important?
Well, I wish I could say they sit up and go, wow. Not only do they not have a great deal of historical knowledge, they have a very little interest in historical knowledge. So they usually look at me. Now, these are undergraduates, okay? Because law in New Zealand is studied as an undergraduate subject. But they kind of right. look at me, these are millennials. Why do we have to go back and look at what was happening in the 40s and the 50s? So it's usually a big
really?
And we don't get into the Nuremberg Code. We go through the Nuremberg principles for the reasons I mentioned uh-huh. at the outset, how it was revolutionary and subjecting, in basically making individuals participants in the international legal community, individuals in a negative sense as defendants before an international tribunal, number one, and then two, spelling out the elements of these crimes, especially crimes against humanity. We usually go through that, and they're like, okay, let's get to more modern stuff because they're pretty antithetical to historical commentary. But I
really?
Think if I were to pitch the code, the Nuremberg Code, and say, listen, this was meant to tell the world the do's and don'ts, i.e. how not to be a Nazi doctor, and that despite this, we see, contemporary medical professionals violating these principles. Are they not acting in a Nazi sort of way? I think they would probably sit up and pay a bit more attention. And certainly, older people will, because, we know what it means to be a Nazi, and we don't want our medical personnel being, acting like Nazis. Younger generation, Catherine, I think I've mentioned this in a prior interview. They don't have a lot of use for history. They just don't. They just don't.
Right.
And I always give a warning before the very first class. I say, I tell them, and not just in this course I teach, but in others, I take a very historical approach to the subjects we're going to cover, meaning you're going to, in some cases, we're going to go back to the 30 Years' War, and we'll start from there. Other times, we'll go back to the Roman Empire. We'll start from there. And they all roll
right.
their eyes and stuff. But I wish they were interested, but they're not.
Well, it's quite remarkable. At one point, I went back. I'd never known my family history. And when I was in the middle of litigation, I drove around the country and sort of downloaded the family history from all the wise elders right before they died. They kind of died off over the next 10 years. And one of the things I discovered is, the tapeworm has been harvesting my family for generations, but every generation had memory wipe. And so, they didn't know how to protect themselves against the next harvest. It's quite extraordinary. They kept thinking this was all sort of a coincidence and bad luck. And what you realized was if they'd taken the time to sort of, and you'll see this, you'll see certain groups are very good at passing that knowledge down so that they don't get harvested. But, a lot of families don't know to conspire together to outwit the, outwit the game. And one of the things I learned is you absolutely want to know your history. You need to know your history if you're going to play the game to win today. I learned that.
That's an excellent statement. You need to know it, certainly at
right.
the macro level, the history of nations, the history of empires, history of economic crises, the history of wars. You know the old saw, if you don't know your history, you're condemned to repeat
right.
it. You need to know it on the family level for the reasons you just stated. And You need to know it on your own individual personal level. If you don't know where you've been, if you don't take an accounting of what you've done for a host of medical reasons, and metaphysical rather, not medical reasons, metaphysical, right, psychological reasons, you might not be where you want to be. So looking back and knowing what's transpired is invaluable on at least three different levels, and probably, right, more.
Well, if you want to be a player and create history, you know, we're creating history. The future is unwritten. We get to participate and play in creating it. But you can't create history forward if you don't understand the threads that that brought you to where you are. So if you want to get in the game and be a player, you've got to know. You've got to have that mastery. And I think the question is, do you want history to just be something that happens to you, or do you want to be part of creating it?
In my view, there can be no wisdom which comes from a deep perspective without a knowledge of what has transpired at,
right,
any of the levels I mentioned. There, right, can be no wisdom.
I agree.
There can be strong reference. There can be a certain practical wisdom, I suppose. Like, I've got an immediate goal. How do I achieve it? But without the perspective that comes from historical knowledge, there's no wisdom. And what is a society without wisdom? What do we have then? I don't think we have much.
It's real simple. You have a mess. That's what we have. We have a mess. I used to have a pastor who would scream every Sunday, "God does not bless a mess."
No, but he certainly allows, but Catherine, he or she allows them to happen.
Right, absolutely.
And free will, he or she is going to let us learn the hard way.
Right.
But, you know, I said in a prior interview, when you asked what can be done about the deep state and the secrecy, and I said in a prior interview, I thought it would be the older generation coming to the rescue of the young, usually. You know, it's the young that lead the revolution, but I think the revolution against globalization and fascism, modern day fascism,
right,
that revolution is going to be led by the oldsters with the historical memory, because the young ones,
right,
although we might be able to enlist them as foot soldiers, Catherine, they don't have a clue, and it's not their fault, God bless them. We haven't given them the tools. They don't have a clue.
Right, but I also think it's our responsibility. In other words, we're supposed to leave a better world for the next generation than the world we found, and that hasn't happened. So I really think we have a responsibility.
We've dropped the ball so hard it ain't even funny. We've really screwed it up. I scratch my head about how it happened. I mean, just on a personal note, my parents were in their early 30s when Kennedy was assassinated, and mid-30s when Vietnam happened, and then Watergate. And you know, actually, I come from a family of medical doctors, so I grew up trusting doctors, unlike you, and very, very smart people. My dad went to Yale Medical School, which is a big, deep state, mm-hmm, medical school. These are very, very smart people, and yet they couldn't see it. They couldn't see what I think is relatively clear concerning all the deep state machinations of the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. They haven't been able to see it, and they're still alive there, and they're just about 90, and they still don't see it. And they were very smart people. So it's left me scratching my head. We have dropped the ball, but boy, have we had a number done on us. Because if you could fool,
right,
my parents,
right,
if you could fool them, you could fool anybody. And my parents both have deep historical knowledge of it. We've had a real number done on us, and it's called Nazism, Nazi propaganda, Nazi propaganda techniques. I know Joseph Farrell's done a lot of work on the Nazi International, and he could speak to this. The Nazification of the United States over the last 70 years.
Well, I don't know if you've had a chance to watch it. The movie of the year before last, was True Stream Video's The Minds of Men, which I cannot recommend highly enough, because it basically goes back and it looks at the technology that came over at the end of the war, which meant, you know, infinite financing of the black budget and the intelligence agencies. And you had an incredible investment in research to develop, you know, the mind control that, I mean, the secret societies have had mind control for centuries, But if you combine the experimentation the Germans did, and then you add that with the infinite financing and sort of research capacity of the United States and the intelligence agencies after the war, we've taken mind control to an unbelievable level. And one of the great things about the Minds of Men is the TruthStream folks just, they dug in, they got the patents, they traced the government money pouring into the, they've nailed the story, and they got a psychiatrist named Peter Breggin who's done great research and fought it for decades. And I'm hoping they'll do an update because they kind of end in the 70s and they've got to bring it up. But if you look at the impact of mind control on the society, it's quite extraordinary. Just
Yeah.
unbelievable. Yeah. Well, Amy Benjamin, I think you're just a treasure. And I want to know, so we've had you in secrecy, we've had you in international treaties, which was absolutely fascinating. I thought it was terrible that Congress had abrogated the appropriations in the budget and war powers. And then when you got a hold of me and explained, no, they've abrogated international treaties, I was like, oh God, it can't be that bad. Anyway, but that was absolutely fascinating. So tell us what you're going to be up to over the next year.
Right. Well, I've got another journal article ready and waiting. I'm not going to tell you what it's about. It's secret.
That's
I
fine.
use secrecy.
That's fine. Yes.
But I will tantalize you with this, that I will not be submitting it for publication until if and when certain arrests are made. And then I will take it out of its drawer and submit it. But it's going to be a doozy. And it's basically written. I wanted to have it ready for when, for if and when a certain group of arrests happen. And then I'll submit it. But it's already written. And then next year I have a long sabbatical to do research, and I'm probably going to turn my attention to this whole open borders phenomenon. And I basically want to write something that will wipe the smug, virtuous, and complacent smile off the faces of those who advocate for open borders, because I vehemently oppose open borders, and I feel it's time that I write something that really goes after that agenda. And
Oh,
will
great.
probably use my research study leave, which is in the first part of 2021, to writing that smile wiping piece.
Well, anything we could do to help, I would love it. So please keep us posted. We want to publish these as soon as they're available and help you in any way we can. So, again, I would encourage everyone to go look at the links to educate yourself about the principles and the code. Any others?
And use them politically. Use
Yes.
them as argument and as a definite shaming mechanism. They're very useful politically.
Absolutely. Amy, it's always a pleasure. You have a wonderful day, and thank you again for making the time on such short notice to join us on the Salera Report. We had a lot of requests for this, and I know it's going to be deeply appreciated.
Thank you for letting me have another conversation with you, Catherine.
Have a great day. Bye.
You too. Bye.